Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. There are several active fires in Northern and Southern California today, burning through thousands of acres and forcing people to leave their homes. We've been keeping an eye on the Kincade Fire in Sonoma County since it started Wednesday night. It's now just 5% contained. And now there are other fires on the move in Southern California. Joining us now from the Command Center for L.A. County's Tick Fire is Sharon McNary, a reporter who covers infrastructure for KPCC. Hi, Sharon.
Hey there.
Give us a picture of what you're seeing now and what's going on there.
Well, I'm in the vast central park for Santa Clarita, which is a city north of Los Angeles, and hundreds of firefighters have been fed breakfast and sent out to relieve the firefighters who came on the scene yesterday. And gradually, those firefighters are like trickling in. They're dirty, they're sweaty, they're sooty, and they're being fed breakfast. We're just waiting for further word of how the fire has been going out in the field.
Yeah, I know it's been a long night for them. What are firefighters saying about the behavior and spread of this fire?
The fire has been spreading from a fairly remote area into the bounds of the city of Santa Clarita. It's moving in a south and west direction, being pushed on some pretty heavy winds. The winds have been sustaining about 20 miles an hour in some parts and gusting to 30 miles an hour.
So wow, heavy gusts.
Yeah, and they worry about the ember cast that can push embers forward to the fire and start new fires.
Right, because it's very hot and very dry. And then that wind, of course. What kinds of impacts are you noticing? We've heard of evacuations, school closures. What else is happening?
Well, because one of the major freeways is closed, that's put a lot of extra traffic on the surface streets. And that only serves to make it more difficult for the very many fire engines that have massed here to get out to their assignments. Mm-hmm. So that is a concern for firefighters to make sure that they're safe. Also, the firefighters are dealing in some areas with burning power poles and downed power lines. Mm. And so that's an additional hazard. There was also a roofing supply place that burned yesterday that's now considered a hazardous materials zone. So they have to keep that from polluting the air and water around it.
Yeah, speaking of those power poles that you brought up, there have been a lot of power outages in the state during this week's hot, windy weather. Was this community part of any planned blackouts? Do people have power where you are?
The place where the fire started was within the footprint of one of the places where Southern California Edison, our large utility, had shut off the power. But we don't know yet if they'd shut off the power before the fire started or after, so that's unclear. Most of the populated area of Santa Clarita does have power, but some areas on the fringes that are more served by rural power lines, those are the ones that we have seen taken down as a protective measure to keep them from sparking fires.
I see. Sharon, you've covered fires in Southern California for many years. What's on your mind as you're out there and you're thinking about today?
Yesterday, last night, they said at least six homes had burned, possibly more, and they wouldn't know until light of day. That's today. So the work of going through the neighborhoods and figuring out what's burned, if they can keep this fire to, you know, less than a handful of homes burned, that would be quite amazing. You never really know when you go into a fire if it's going to be one of those handful of fires, homes burned, or, you know, massive destruction.
Yeah, absolutely. Sharon McNary covers infrastructure for KPCC and is reporting today on fires burning in Southern California. Sharon, thank you so much.
You bet. Happy to help.
Well, it is Friday, so let's get to our regular check-in on how the news of the week is playing out on social media. And joining us for that is Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
And let's start with that fire. This is one of those stories that a lot of people tend to go to social media, post photos, etc. What are you seeing?
Sure. Well, having heard that last conversation that you just had on Here and Now, it would beg a belief that anyone would see the fires, the California fires, as a matter of amusement. But on social media, there are always a few people who are not taking a situation seriously. As Shira says, for instance, if you are making jokes about California fires, know that you are hurting real people. A year ago, I lost everything I had, including my two dogs, my kitten, three neighbors on my street, to the campfire. Mm-hmm. My hometown of Paradise will never come back the same. It is not a joke. A couple of people are saying that on social, because sometimes on social, you forget where you are. You forget that if something's not right on your doorstep, you shouldn't be making a joke. It seems like common sense, but not always. Very up close and personal posts. Some of the pictures that people are sharing are stunning, but then you have to remember that through the haze, there are some real dangerous situations mm-hmm. out there. Offers of advice as well. Steph says on this post, to anybody who's had to evacuate the Tick Fire and they've left their pets behind, which is something that people are saying, do not leave your pets behind. If you couldn't make it out on time, you can call animal control and they'll eventually get your pets out of your home. Mm. Lots of advice coming through as well. What should you take? People forget. This is all on social, Jeremy. It's an amazing resource. So credit cards, take your pets, your prescriptions, your documents, your hard drives, those sort of things. And a quote from the mayor, California's mayor, also going around. I would say it was a little viral. This is his quote, his take on what is happening in California. This is climate change, but it is more than climate change. It is corporate greed feeding climate change. It is federal government greed feeding climate change. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in California are retweeting that, resharing that. So there's an awful lot out there. I found that all underneath the hashtag California fires. And people are also recommending, do not use that hashtag unless you have something useful to help the
people who are in the fire.
Right. So it's like a repository of advice and information.
Okay, let's ask about another story in the news. It has been 2 years now since the first reports of rape and sexual assault allegations against film producer Harvey Weinstein. And this week, he turned up at an event in New York, and the person on stage, Zoe Stuckless, called him out. There's a video. Here's a bit of it.
Nobody's going to say anything. Nobody's really going to say anything. I'll get out of here. That's fine. I am happy to leave.
Stuckless was asked to leave and later said they were in complete disbelief because they didn't think that Harvey Weinstein would ever show up at an event like that. What's the reaction been online?
Well, the reason we had that little episode then, we were able to share it with our listeners, is because there was a whole series of tweets from the event. It was almost like a mini documentary, video and tweets and photographs of Harvey Weinstein as well. Remembering that this was an event dedicated to young artists in New York. So Francoise says, in a sarcastic voice, thank you for inviting Weinstein to a young actor's evening. How rude and blind can one be? Thank you for being furious. And that thank you is to Zoe. And then there's a whole debate about whether he should even be out and about and talking to people. Marcel, and the debate goes back and forth between men and women, and a lot of men are also very supportive of the young woman who was on stage who said that this was traumatizing for her. Marcel says, for instance, it shouldn't have been her who should have to have left. The organizers should have kicked out Weinstein instead. Here is the pushback, very interesting pushback, and that comes from Harrogate Dogs. That's the handle on Twitter. Sorry, I don't believe in vigilante justice. I believe in the rule of the law. As with all of us, he should be allowed his day in court and not subjected to publicity seeking vigilantes. That was not a popular thought, Jeremy.
And his day in court, by the way, is coming up in January. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a political story that has been playing out on social media and involves the internet.
This is a good one.
Former Vice President and current presidential candidate Joe Biden launched a Latino voter outreach program on Wednesday called Todos con Biden, which means everyone with Biden.
Oh, you're so good at Spanish.
But the candidate
Muy bien.
Did not register the website or get the Twitter handle with that name, so the Trump campaign did. What happened?
Yeah, everyone with Biden except his digital team, perhaps. So usually when you are launching a campaign, you have an idea, you've got an eye for idea for a website, what you would normally do is check out who's got that title. Does it exist already? Do I need to come up with something more original? And then once you've got it, then you buy up and make sure you've secured the website names, the Facebook name, make sure nobody else has got that, all the social and digital handles so you have that. The digital team for Joe Biden didn't do that. So the re-elect Trump team did it instead. So when you click on something that you think would be Todos con Biden and you're expecting to see Joe Biden's campaign messages, you see, oops, Joe Biden forgot about Latinos. And then there are on Facebook, there are comments that Joe Biden has said over the years, some of them not necessarily the most complimentary about different minorities. And so the Trump campaign is having a field day because the digital team of Joe Biden didn't think ahead. So that's a lesson learned right there.
Well, and I have to think that the Trump campaign knows very well, or at least Donald Trump knows very well, that you have to register things, which is why his Twitter handle is Real Donald Trump, presumably because when he went on Twitter for the first time,
somebody else
had Donald Trump.
Right?
Exactly. That is Femi Okey, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, always great to have you. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too, Jeremy. Take care.
And by the way, I think Femi was referring to a tweet from California Governor Gavin Newsom.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
President Trump lifted sanctions on Turkey this week, saying Turkey had assured him it would halt fighting against the Kurds in Syria. But there are reports today of clashes between Turkish and Kurdish forces there. The fighting started after President Trump abruptly pulled American forces out of the border area earlier this month, saying it was time to bring U.S. troops home. Joining us in the studio to talk about this and other stories in the news is former Democratic Congresswoman Jane Harman. She's in town for a Harvard Law School reunion. She is president and CEO of the Wilson Center. Great to see you in person. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. I wasn't sure you existed.
I'm a real person. I'm not just a disembodied voice. Let me ask you about Syria. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said today that the U.S. is going to keep a reduced military presence on the ground in Syria to stop ISIS from taking over oil fields there. There are reports the White House is considering keeping 500 troops in northeast Syria, which would be a reversal. Does the U.S. have a strategy there?
No. We seem to have a process-free foreign and security policy, which is very dangerous. We do have parts of government, including the National Security Council and the White House, led by a guy I just met this week, Robert O'Brien, who seems quite capable. And we do have a State Department, and we do have a Defense Department, and all of the principals and deputies should have been considering carefully what the day after and the day after that would look like if we took some of our troops out of Syria. I don't believe that happened. I think most people were blindsided by the decision, and now we're paying a price. I mean, what's happening here is that a plan that was underway to create a security zone between Turkey and Syria, which would take care of Turkey's worries about the Kurds invading Turkey, was just about to be put in place. And instead of that, we took the U.S. troops out of that part of Syria and destabilized all of Syria.
What are the long-term consequences for the United States?
Well, we'll find out.
But what are your concerns?
My concern is that we have destroyed our credibility. We also have created a vacuum filled already by, to some extent, the Turks, plus the Russians, and the Assad government, which has used chemical weapons on its people, has free rein. And, oh, by the way, there's a rumor that chemical weapons have been used during this exercise to remove the Kurds. It's not clear by whom.
By Turkey, you think?
By Turkey or a Turkish ally. Now, who could that be? Sounds like Assad to me, but it's being investigated by the UN, so I don't know. And if that's true, that is just heinous. And a consequence we might have anticipated if we'd had a reasonable process in place.
What about ISIS? How concerned are you that ISIS will now regroup and be a threat to the U.S. or Europe or the West in general?
Very concerned. I mean, there were prisons in that swath of land that Turkey has been attacking. There were prisons there of ISIS fighters. These prisons were horrendous. It is not clear yet who has escaped. But these ISIS fighters in that area probably came from Europe. And if they did, what will they want to do if they're free? They're going to want to go through the porous Turkish border and back into Europe and stage attacks in Europe and, you know, possibly through Europe to the U.S. So I think this has potentially set us back quite a lot.
Do you think that Turkey should be booted out of NATO as a result of what just happened?
Well, it's a decision for NATO to make. I mean, Turkey also did another no-no recently, which is to buy a massive air defense system called the S-400 from Russia. NATO exists as a collective defense organization to keep the West free. It doesn't exist as an attack, you know, outfit against Russia. But Russia is, I mean, given its actions in Ukraine and Crimea, a threat to NATO. And so now if you have a NATO member purchasing its major defense system from Russia, that's, let's say, awkward.
You're here with us today. Yesterday, the Wilson Center hosted Vice President Mike Pence. He gave a speech which made news, and you interviewed him, and he criticized China's actions against protesters in Hong Kong. He called out the NBA, which has apologized for a tweet sent by the Houston Rockets general manager that supported the protesters and angered China. Listen to Mike Pence.
In siding with the Chinese Communist Party and silencing free speech, the NBA is acting like a wholly owned subsidiary of that authoritarian regime. A progressive corporate culture that willfully ignores the abuse of human rights is not progressive, it is repressive.
Jane Herman, what did you make of those comments? And I just before you answer, I want to read you what President Trump said. He's been very silent on the Hong Kong protesters, but this is what he said on August 1st. Somebody said that at some point they're going to want to stop that, they being China. But that's between Hong Kong and that's between China because Hong Kong is a part of China. They'll have to deal with that themselves. They don't need advice. Now the vice president is calling out the NBA for not standing up for the Hong Kong protesters.
Well, let me explain that Vice President Pence has spoken at the Wilson Center before. I served in Congress with him for 5 terms, so I know him reasonably well. He came back yesterday, and he picked the topic, not the Wilson Center. I thought the speech was interesting. It was hard-hitting in part, stuff we've all heard. The part on Hong Kong surprised me because President Trump has not said that.
But it's the part of the speech that made news. What else stood out to you in what he said yesterday?
You know, if you think the first part was hard power, the last part was soft power. He said, we have to coexist with China. President Xi and President Trump have a good relationship. And going forward, we have our differences, but we want to figure out how to work together. And I thought that was an important line as well.
The impeachment inquiry is on pause today in honor of the late Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings, whose funeral has been going on today. First of all, just your thoughts on the legacy of Elijah Cummings.
Well, I knew Elijah quite well, and he was the North Star of the House. But the comment about Elijah Cummings is he was one of the rare people who still worked there who could have not just private but public friendships with somebody of a completely different set of views. And one of his friendships was with Mark Meadows, a co-founder of the Freedom Caucus. Mm-hmm. And live on TV during the contentious Kavanaugh hearings, Meadows got offended by something. And right then, Elijah, as chairman of the committee, said, "Now, Mark, I think you misunderstood this. It means something else. And you and I have been friends for years. Now let's just reason together about how to understand it." And boy, watching that just on TV, my heart opened to the fact that there still are a few people, sadly, another voice has been stilled, but a few people up there who are amenable to working out problems and misunderstandings.
But still a lot of differences right now, even between Mark Meadows and the Democrats on the issue of impeachment and this impeachment inquiry. What do you make of what we've seen, all these people coming in to be deposed, to testify on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think it remains to be seen what all the facts will show. But what do I make of it so far? I think it's been a responsible process. I don't like leaks, and I think it would be better if members of the committee maybe just dialed down a little bit the urge to be on TV on both sides. In the end, impeachment is a drastic remedy. I've seen two. One was the Nixon impeachment when I was a young counsel, as I mentioned. I did not have a direct role. The second was the Clinton impeachment, where I was a member of Congress and voted against the impeachment counts in the House because I didn't think they rose to a high crime and misdemeanor. And then, as you know, he was not convicted in the Senate. And in the end, he came out stronger. And so a lesson learned here is this remedy has to be used very carefully. But it only works if the country's behind it. And I do think there's an effort at this stage to see whether the country understands what's going on and believes the facts. And we'll see. The polls are changing. The polls that I hear show at least 50% of the people that are polled think that the impeachment should proceed.
What number does that have to get up to for you to believe that the country is behind impeachment?
Well, it needs to get higher than 50. I don't know if we really agree on most anything, although it seems to me that there are a few issues that rise to high numbers, like the need to curb gun violence would be one. I wish we could address that in some civil way. Curb gun violence, not control and remove guns. Curb gun violence. I say that because that is something I think the country could agree on.
Okay, I want to ask you one more thing. We've been talking about the issues that are in the news right now. If we weren't talking about these things that we've been talking about, what would you say is the most important thing that America should be dealing with right now from a foreign policy perspective?
I think we should restore process to foreign policy. I think all the issues are hard. I think most of the issues are linked. For sure, North Korea didn't miss the movie when Trump pulled out of the agreement we had to contain Iran's nuclear weapons. And I'm sure that Kim Jong-un thought, oh, if I make an agreement with Trump, maybe he'll pull out of my agreement, too. So I think that set back, my view, our effort to deal with North Korea. If we'd had a process that worked, we might have connected those two things. That's an example. Pulling out of Syria and, oh, by the way, we're back to protect the oil fields, I think sent a message that's not just going to be heard or is being heard in the Middle East, but I think other countries are measuring Trump as well and trying to see, how to gauge things. I think if there's more predictability in our foreign policy, even if the U.S. wants a smaller footprint in the world, something I'm not necessarily in agreement with, but even if the U.S. wants a smaller footprint, let's have it be decided on an organized basis with proper messaging and consideration for the day after and the day after the day after.
That's former Congresswoman Jane Harman, President and CEO of the Wilson Center, in our studios today. Thank you and have a great time at your Harvard Law School reunion.
Thank you, Jeremy. And for viewers who've never seen you, you look like
person.
A very nice man.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Companies are reporting their third quarter earnings this week, and there are some surprises. Amazon's profits fell for the first time in more than 2 years, and Twitter stock is down more than 20%. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tanya.
So it feels like big tech has been the darling of Wall Street for so long. It's a little surprising to see this kind of dip. Let's talk about Amazon first. What explains that 26% drop in profits compared to last year?
Well, throughout its history, Amazon has sort of made it clear that maximizing profits in the present day was not really its number one priority. They'd much rather spend some of those profits by spending aggressively on projects that they think will boost sales in the long term. And that's really the case again in this quarter. They spent a lot to invest in one-day shipping. And it turned out to be very popular with customers, but it is very expensive. So sales at stores, their online store was actually up 21%, but those shipping costs were up 46%.
Mm.
But again, Amazon's strategy has always been to sort of sacrifice those profits in the near term. in exchange for what they think is a good long-term investment to boost sales in the long term. And that seems to be what they're doing here, too.
Okay, let's talk about Twitter. It took one of its biggest beatings ever in the market after its shares dropped more than 20% following its Q3 earnings. What happened there?
Well, you know, they describe it as bugs in basically the software that allows them to target users with ads. Some of it stems from some issues they had with collecting information from people on the devices they were using. They were doing this basically without permission and ended that situation. So it did cause this sort of bump in the road for them to successfully deliver ads to a real narrowly targeted audience. And as a result, it resulted in less revenue coming in from advertising, which is obviously the vast majority of how they make their money.
Right. And we should mention that Twitter's users, it actually still continues to grow. One other interesting big tech story today, Facebook is launching a new news service for a test audience of 200,000 users. It's a new model Facebook is trying where it pays newspapers for their content. How big of a game changer do you think this might be for the news industry?
Well, it's certainly a positive for them to actually get paid for this content. You know, these companies will happily cash those checks.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's a game changer, I think it depends on if the users of Facebook actually adopt this new functionality pretty on a widespread basis. I mean, I think the appeal of Facebook to a lot of people is seeing what news their friends share and then having a conversation about it. And this is kind of a different way for Facebook to present the news to people. And it's we'll have to see if people sort of embrace this new way of getting the news off of Facebook. But it's certainly a positive, again, for these companies to actually get paid and for the traffic to be directed towards their sites rather than staying within that Facebook environment is
right,
probably
because that
a positive.
Has always been a big point of contention for media outlets is not being able to have folks leave the site once they're able to click on their content within Facebook.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's definitely a positive for the news companies as well.
Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And this note, Facebook and Amazon are among NPR's recent financial supporters, and NPR is one of the news outlets that will be featured in Facebook's news tab. Iowa residents will cast the first votes of the 2020 presidential race 100 days from now during the First in the Nation caucus on February 3rd. In 2016, the state voted for Donald Trump after choosing Barack Obama in the previous two elections. Earlier this week, we heard how Republicans in Iowa are attempting to shore up support in the counties that flipped from blue to red. But this time around, Democrats hope to retake the state, and voters are split over which candidate can do it. Here and Now's Chris Bentley reports.
Let's dream big, fight hard, and win.
Elizabeth Warren supporters are packed into a split-level house in suburban Dubuque, Iowa, networking and getting tips from local campaign organizers on canvassing voters. Rachel Guin is among them. She's 25 and works at a publishing company in Dubuque. Guin says she's volunteering for the campaign because she thinks Warren is the best candidate to beat Trump.
I do, because I think all of her ideas are bigger than just her, and they're bigger than Trump. She said recently that Trump is a symptom of a larger problem of corruption, and that's the thing that she's fighting against the most, to remove corruption from the office, like inside and out. And that's why I think she's the best candidate.
Warren is among four candidates polling in double digits in Iowa. She's running neck and neck with former Vice President Joe Biden for the lead. But not far behind them are Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, whose poll numbers have risen in recent weeks. William Spencer is a special education teacher in Dubuque. At 50 years old, he's decided to caucus and volunteer for a campaign for the first time. He and his wife are backing Buttigieg.
He is pragmatic. I don't see him as being too far either way. I think he will appeal to people like me that maybe had checked out.
Spencer had voted for Republican presidential candidates since 1996, but says he couldn't bring himself to vote for Trump, so he left the top of the ballot blank in 2016. He thinks Buttigieg has the best chance of winning independents in Iowa, who swung for Trump last time.
Pete gives me faith that he will not only can unite the Democratic Party, which really didn't seem united in 2016, but I think he can reach out and pull back some of those center-right people that are like, you know what, I may not agree with him on everything, but he's reasonable.
Appealing to independents is an important part of any presidential campaign in Iowa, where there are more active voters not registered with any party than there are registered Democrats or Republicans. Mark Mueller has caucused for both Democrats and Republicans in the past, and he hasn't decided which candidate he'll support next year. Mueller is a retired logistics manager for the U.S. Army. He says as a veteran, he's dismayed by Trump's decision-making process, especially when it comes to foreign policy. Mueller says he likes Biden and Warren, and Tom Steyer, and Senator Kamala Harris.
Most of the candidates have a great chance for electability if you look at where they stand and what they have to say, and I'm not worried about age, because if you pick a good vice president, if you pick good cabinet heads, they will carry on.
Electability is a top priority for Judy Schmidt, a retired English teacher in Dubuque. I spoke with her in a coffee shop, and she says the race has gotten more confusing in the last few months.
People are excited. Democrats are excited. And they do want someone who will defeat Trump. But the people I've talked to have said that they were more sure which candidate they were going to support during the summertime than now.
Schmidt's top two choices right now are Joe Biden, whom she says will calm the waters, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar.
She's like me, very down-to-earth, very practical. She understands that people are tired of the chaos and the mess that Trump has created, and they want some normalcy, they want some calmness, and I see her that way.
Schmidt's right that there's no clear favorite yet in Iowa. A Suffolk University USA Today poll this week found the number of likely Democratic caucus-goers who say they're undecided is 29%. Up 8 points from a few months ago. But not everyone agrees with her that a moderate would be the best choice for the party in 2020. Tom Townsend is president of the Dubuque Federation of Labor. He says like many working-class Democrats in the area, he held his nose and voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016.
A lot of our members felt like in the primary that the party had screwed Bernie Sanders out of the nomination, and I think that brought up a lot of anger towards Hillary Clinton. You bundle that all together with the fact that Trump was talking to working people. He was going to be there fighting for the average working person. Instead, he worked for tax cuts for really wealthy people.
Labor is a key constituency for any Democrat hoping to win industrial Dubuque. Townsend says Sanders is still a strong contender. But this time around, union voters have options.
It really is good when you hear, how many different candidates, including, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Buttigieg, all of them are talking about how are we going to expand union membership and that they want to double, the number of members in unions. Buttigieg specifically is talking about gig workers and workers that have never been represented before. They all have their strengths and they all have their weaknesses, but every one of them has a labor platform, and I think that's encouraging.
There's something else that Democrats in eastern Iowa find encouraging. Their party won three of the state's four congressional seats in last year's midterm elections, including here in the state's first district, where freshman Abby Finkenauer unseated a two-term Republican incumbent. Donna Duvall heads the Democratic Party in rural Jackson County, part of Finkenauer's district. She says she always votes, but didn't get involved with politics until after the 2016 election.
So I became politically active because of Trump. And there are a number of people like me who've done that.
To win in 2020, Democrats will have to improve voter turnout. Trump won Iowa in 2016 amid a dip in turnout for both parties, but especially Democrats. And even last year, when the highest midterm turnout in decades helped Democrats flip two congressional districts, Republicans in Iowa still saw a higher turnout than Democrats and no-party voters. But Duvall says Democrats in Iowa are energized to vote Trump out of office next year, no matter who their candidate is.
I would vote for any of the candidates. I would go out and work hard for any of the candidates. And I think the most important thing that Democrats need to do is to come together. Once the caucus is over, once we have a candidate, then come together and work for that candidate. Because any of the candidates, any of them at all, would be better than Trump.
And with just over 3 months until the Iowa caucuses, it remains to be seen which candidate will get the chance to take on Donald Trump. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Bentley.
Well, presidential hopefuls spend much of their campaigns talking at voters. NPR has brought candidates face-to-face to speak with them in personal settings. As part of our series Off Script, Andrew Yang sat down with NPR's Noel King and two undecided voters at a Chinese restaurant in Manhattan. The millionaire entrepreneur and Democratic contender is best known for his plan to guarantee income for every American. But the voters also wanted to hear his ideas on transforming the educational system. Let's listen to his response.
The data shows that two-thirds of our kids' academic performance is determined by factors outside of the school. So that's parental time spent with the children, words read to them when they're young, stress levels in the household, type of neighborhood. And educators know this, where we're saying, you know, teach our kids. And they're like, yeah, I'm responsible, or I can control about a third of what goes on to the kid. They're like, well, you're 100% accountable. And they're like, okay. So number one, if you put resources into the household, you're actually getting the kids in a better position to learn and then helping the teachers be in a better position to teach. And that ends up balancing out more aggressively for communities that are starting at a lower base, which tends to be, unfortunately, communities of color in this country. Number two, the data clearly shows that a good teacher is worth his or her weight in gold, so we should pay teachers more. We need to retain and enlist better teachers. There are so many teachers who are leaving the classroom because of burnout and the rest of it. Relatedly, we need more teachers. Data also shows that having individualized attention, very, very positive for kids. Having lower student-to-teacher ratio is very, very positive. So we need to staff up. The fourth thing is we need to lighten the emphasis on standardized tests that right now is making our teachers make these choices in the classroom where they know that it's not good for the kid, but they're like, well, I'm going to get evaluated on this test, and the kid's going to get evaluated on this test, so let's head to this direction. And one of my boys is autistic, and so he's neurologically atypical, and while that's relatively extreme, there are many atypical kids in our schools today that are just getting beaten over the head with these standardized tests, and you know, and many of them are having their self-esteem crushed and their hopes for the future altered forever. We invented the SAT during World War II as a means to determine which kids not to send to the front lines, and now we're using it every year like it's wartime. And we're treating our kids like it's wartime every year. So we need to de-emphasize these tests and let the teachers actually do their jobs.
That was presidential hopeful Andrew Yang speaking with two undecided voters and NPR's Noel King. It's part of our series Off Script, Conversations with Candidates.
Hot on the heels of their hit Chernobyl, HBO debuted a new limited series this week called Catherine the Great, a four-parter starring Helen Mirren as the 18th century Russian empress. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Okay, and it's been a while since my Russian history class, but remind us, Catherine the Great, what is this show about?
Oh, so you're going to make me be the Russian historian, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so basically, Catherine, as I understand it, took power after her lover and some other folks working with her killed her husband, and she reigned for about 30 years, I believe, and was known as a benevolent despot in that she tried to rule with an enlightened strategy. She advanced the idea of inoculating people against diseases. She spoke out against the slavery of serfdom, and also pushed to increase the size and the boundary of the Russian country. And so she was very ambitious. She was very paranoid about anyone trying to take power because she was a female ruler of a country that didn't think women had the ability to lead. And in fact, she faced a lot of odd rumors about her sexual proclivities and her mental state. And so we have a clip where she's talking to her lover who helped kill her husband so that she could take power. Let's check it out.
Remember who I am now. Have you forgotten? You would do so at your peril.
We killed your husband.
I know who killed my husband. I have it in black and white, in your bloody brother's handwriting.
You watch and you wait, and then you move against people.
Everything I do is wrong, isn't it?
So you hear the frustration there because he realizes that she's sort of losing patience with him and that she's beginning to have a wandering eye. And eventually, she will strike up a romance with Potemkin.
By the way, it reminds me that in Chernobyl, all the Russians had British accents too. And it kind of works, I have to say, as an American to watch that. I can sort of believe
it. Well, I was going to say actually that it is a little weird only because it's Russian history, but you're hearing British accents and even British slang. They always have these lines where they're constantly talking about their Russianness, I think, to constantly remind the viewer that it is not Britain, but Russia.
Well, and especially when you're talking about Helen Mirren, who, of course, has played Queen Elizabeth I and the II. In this case, she is Catherine the Great. But by the way, Eric, she was born Helen Mironov to an English mother and a Russian father. I want to listen to another clip here. This is where Catherine sees enemies in everyone, even her trusted advisor, Panin.
How much does he know about what's going on at Schlüsselburg?
Nothing, I swear it, Your Majesty.
Never talk about the succession or about power sharing. Do you understand me?
Yes, Your Majesty. I want responsibility for the boy, that's all, Your Majesty. I have always been loyal to you, ever since we put his father from the throne.
She's a scary Catherine the Great, Eric.
She is. And that discussion is about her son, because there was some thinking that once he became of age, she might cede power, and she refused to do that. And she was always paranoid that people might engage some sort of coup against her by leveraging her son. And so the miniseries manages to get at all of this, including this romance that she had with Potemkin, who the miniseries at least presents as her true love, even though she had a lot of partners during her reign. And there's constantly this push and pull between her wanting to have a full romantic life, but also wanting to be respected as a leader and as somebody who's going to expand the boundaries of the Russian Empire by taking on the Turks, for example, and peacefully annexing the Crimea, which sounds an awful lot like some stuff that's going on in contemporary times. So we're looking back in time to see the original blueprint of the Russian country that was stamped by Catherine the Great, that some people believe folks like Vladimir Putin are trying to live up to.
I have to say I'm very happy to see HBO doing more miniseries, which are easy to watch because they're not that big of a commitment. This is just 4 episodes. But, Eric, HBO is also coming out right now with Watchmen. It's going to be a big show, the final season of Silicon Valley. They're churning them out like Netflix right now.
Well, you know, one thing that we heard is that their new owners, Warner Media, is expecting them to have more hits year-round to engage viewers with a more robust slate of programming. They don't just want to have viewers at a time when a show like Game of Thrones or Veep is on. They want to have people engaged with HBO all year round. And so, you know, Euphoria is a series that seemed to do well and get a lot of attention. We have Watchmen now. This is Catherine the Great miniseries. It's well produced. The costumes are amazing and the settings are wonderful and the actors are great. You know, the only criticism I would have for it is that it is a little confusing if you don't know Russian history. But if you're willing to just give yourself up to the romanticism of it and to the interpersonal drama, it's a pretty enjoyable miniseries.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Something to watch after Succession, Tanya. When I'm
done
with that.
Yeah, those Catherine the Great billboards are everywhere in L.A.
Oh, yeah. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Investigative reporter Ronan Farrow has made the rounds talking about his new book, and he tells us the process hasn't been easy for him.
As I report on each of these stories, there are these very below-the-belt attacks. You know, Harvey Weinstein's legal threat letters to me are not, shall we say, Hallmark card stuff.
That's next time on Here and Now.